there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you, as ever, for joining us. I just spoke with Winnie Wong about her recent book, Van Gogh on Demand, China and the Ready-Made. This came out in 2013 with University of Chicago Press. And it's really, really interesting, not only if you are interested in contemporary China, but also if you're interested in art and contemporary art more broadly, and the kinds of issues, the kinds of larger conceptual categories and really practical categories that have tended to be associated with the production of images, the production of objects, and the idea of and the figure of the contemporary Chinese producer. So what I mean by that is that the book is really taking on some assumptions that readers might have about the culture of copying and forging specifically in modern China within a global capitalist frame, and is upending not just how we understand China in this context, but also how we understand the practices of creativity, of copying, of forgery, of production and practice more generally, and of, you know, what it is to be an artist, both to perform that and also to identify someone else as that kind of figure. So among all of these things, the book is contributing importantly to how we understand labor, and it's making two important points about the Dafen context in particular. The first one is that conceptual labor and manual labor, labor with the hands, are at work in all painterly practices, no matter which ones, no matter who's doing them, and that includes practices that might be associated with copying, right? And the second one is that there's a hierarchy among artists that's inherent in the division between what we might call material labor and immaterial labor. And this hierarchy undermines, it contradicts the basic values of what Wong calls democratic and universal creativity in conceptual art. And so that last point is really specifically geared toward how we understand what conceptual art is, what kind of labor is involved, who gets to practice it, and what and where it is. The book is also challenging notions of Dafen painters specifically. As she puts it in the book, the painters have been understood typically as she calls it, especially unfree victims. And this is victims either of a kind of global capitalist system or a totalitarian communist state that really helps us understand or makes us understand Dafen painters as being just copiers that are incapable of producing original and creative art. The book undoes this assumption. It really looks at the practices of painters as a way to get away from an understanding of them as victims. And it also shows us that notions we might take for granted, originality, creativity, the artistic persona, are performances, they're constructions, and they operate in Dafen and they also operate elsewhere. So the book is doing a lot of really interesting kinds of work. And Winnie, as she was describing her own fieldwork and her own practices, has some really fascinating things to say about how these practices are unfolding on the ground. So I hope you have a chance to get your hands on a copy of the book. It's quite beautiful. The images are really central to the work that the book is doing, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks very much for listening. I'm here today to talk with Winnie Wong about her new book, Van Gogh on Demand. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Winnie, and thanks both for writing an amazing book and also a quite beautiful book, and also for making time to talk with me about it today. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's really nice to talk to you.
Of course. So, Winnie, can you start us off, as is kind of traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field, and specifically, how did you come to decide to work on art in contemporary China?
My main interest in this project was, first of all, actually in contemporary China, and specifically in the city of Shenzhen. It was a place I knew a little bit about from doing my undergraduate thesis on public space in Hong Kong. And it was just something that I had, it was a place that I had always just been curious about. And so I had initially planned to do a project on counterfeit handbags in Shenzhen. Yes, and but by the time I was halfway through graduate school, Chinese art, Chinese contemporary art had at that moment just sort of exploded in both academic and museum interest. And so I had sort of done a sort of, I had been interested, you know, I had done my qualifying exams in Chinese art. But really I had a hard time finding the kind of artists and works that really compelled me to do a, you know, really large project. And at the time, Daffin Village was featured on the cover of New York Times. And of course, since it had to do with fakes and forgeries and authenticity, many, many friends sent it to me, the article, and I completely ignored it and thought it was the silliest thing ever. I thought, of course, there's a village in China that makes copies of, you know. And so I put it aside. And what was funny was that I was in Beijing and then in Shanghai when the subject of Daffin kept coming up again. And then I went to Shenzhen to, you know, examine counterfeit handbags. And I thought, well, I better go see this place. And I ended up going with the art historian Gu Yi, and also an independent ethnographer of Shenzhen, Marianne O'Donnell. And the three of us went there one day, and it was just the most incredible, unbelievable sort of experience we had, where every person, just, you know, the first person we encountered, a painter, just said the most amazing things about art. Funny, amazing, absurd, and insightful, all at once. And I think that interview, the first encounter we had at Daffin, basically was what I had in the next 6 years. Every time I went to Daffin, another person, another painter, another boss would just say something incredible that would just completely question my questions. And so it became a natural project for me.
Wow. And the we'll hear a lot more about this, I'm sure, in the hour to come, but the research for the book actually includes the fruit of many of these conversations. And so you describe the fieldwork early in the book that undergirded this study, as it included artist interviews, studio visits, participant observation alongside a range of different kinds of people. So local officials, bosses, interpreters, foreign artists, buyers, traders, and you also describe, and we'll get to this later on in the conversation, the experience of learning how to be a painter in this context. So there's lots of really cool conversations that you bring us into. So the study started out as a doctoral project. So can you talk about that transition for us? Were there any kind of major transformations or changes in the way either you were structuring the project, you were conceptualizing the project, or really any major elements of the transition from dissertation to book that stand out for you as particularly notable?
It was actually very simple in my case. The dissertation ended up having a much longer historical scope because it became obvious as soon as I began that the history of Chinese export painting is a history of this region, or at least it's been in this region for 200 years. And so my dissertation actually began in the 18th century and went right up to 2010. What I decided to do with the book was to separate the historical project from the contemporary project, not just because the contemporary project was sort of a piece and because it involved sort of a method of working with living artists and international artists and adopting a certain kind of ethnographic mode, but also because the history itself has a huge gap between about 1850 and 1950. And in the dissertation, I dealt with that with very, very little sort of a scant bits of guesses and evidence of, say, every decade from 1850 to 1950, what I thought might have happened. But really, I would find that a really, really difficult task to cover. And so in essence, what I did with the dissertation was separate it into two books, one which is the post-Mao period and one which is the second project that I'm working on, which ends in 1850. So that was a very sort of simple organizational and methodological sort of refinement, I guess, I made from the dissertation to the book. And the second main thing I really did with the book was initially basically just spend a lot of time working on the tone of the writing. I wanted very much to engage with a number of audiences with this project, and I also wanted very much to express a certain kind of empathy, but also irony and humor with the ethnographic material. And so it became very much a challenge to write it so that the positions would be, I don't know how to say, understandable. Mm-hmm. I wanted very much not to make fun of these painters. On the other hand, I wanted to highlight the irony with which they were approaching their own lives.
Great. Thank you so much. So we've been talking about this village, this area, Dafen, and this is something that really is at the, you know, the basic stratum upon which the built or the book is built. So let's get this straight mm-hmm. right at the beginning for listeners mm-hmm. who aren't familiar with this. And this is maybe a way to bring us into really the heart and the body of the book itself. Mm-hmm. So the book opens on a 2004 copying competition in this village of Dafen, China. So to get us started, what is this village, right? I mean, where is mm-hmm. this? What do we need to know basically about Dafen as a place to be mm-hmm. able to then move to understanding copying as a practice and a process in that place?
So what's interesting about Dafen is that it is in many ways not unique at all. And in many ways, made to be unique. So Dafen Village is actually properly called now a neighborhood committee overseen by the Buji Street Level Office, which is in Longgang District, just outside what was once the special economic zone of Shenzhen. And so it is a place which is very much like all of the villages in Shenzhen, which became the present-day city of Shenzhen, and which today we call urban villages or urbanized villages. And this is, you know, a particularly complicated history. But what we need to know is that there were original villagers who became landlords, who accepted foreign direct investment, created a corporation, and that many, many migrant workers live and work in what was the former village. We need to also know that there was a lot of Hong Kong-based and foreign access to the place, and because of its proximity to Hong Kong. But so the position of Dafen is important here because it is just outside the one of the major checkpoints of what we call the second line or the internal boundary of the city of Shenzhen. It is a place that was affordable for workers, for migrant workers, and it was a place that was also accessible to Hong Kong and foreign traders. So that's its sort of particular kind of history, not unlike many, many urban villages in Shenzhen at different points of its history. But maybe I could just say that what made Dafen unique, and also, you know, what Dafen produces, these oil paintings for the Western market, are in no way unique, not unique to China, not unique to Dafen, not unique to Shenzhen. I found it in many places in the world, including New Jersey and Naples, Italy. But what does make Dafen unique and so visible was that it was made the first model cultural industry of China in 2004, and thereafter just got a lot of press and propaganda attention.
And one of the really wonderful things about the book, and this is, I think, true throughout all of the chapters, is it really takes these ideas that many readers probably, I mean, I certainly did come to the book taking for granted the idea of uniqueness itself, the idea of originality, the idea of individuality, the idea of copying. Mm-hmm. And it really upends what we think we understand when we understand these notions, and it makes the story of the locality of these notions, local emergence and complexity of them, really, really beautifully interesting and really, really inspiring, I think. So one of the notions that you are very much calling into question here is the notion of copying itself. Mm-hmm. Based on a familiarity with things like New York Times articles and popular press, etc., again, readers might come to this thinking, oh, well, these Dafan paintings, a bunch of these painters, you know, they just copy from an original. These are paintings that are just forgeries, etc., etc. And you're very careful here to claim, at least at one point, you claim that these are actually the very opposite of forgeries. Mm-hmm. And part of that has to do with the way that we understand a copy here. Mm-hmm. So to lay that groundwork for us to build on as we get into subsequent chapters, can you open up for us this idea of the gao, or the copy? What is a copy in this context, and how does it shape the notion of what copying as a practice becomes for these painters?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am trying to explain why I've come to argue really that what Dafan painters do is not copying. By looking at their practice, and I think it was very surprising to me that when Van Gogh teacher taught me to paint a few sunflowers, that his main instruction was to not look at the gao. So, and rather that if I kept looking at the gao, meaning the model from which I thought I was copying, I would not produce a good painting. And this was the instruction he gave me repeatedly, and that his own teacher would come in every day to give me as well. And that was sort of my first clue that there was something fundamentally, not just theoretically different, but that in practice that was very, very different from what our expectations were. So I use the concept of the gao because it has a particular kind of circulation within the practices of Dafan painters. And a gao, as we know in Chinese, really just means a draft or something from which you are looking at or working from. We use it in literature just to mean a manuscript copy. But I think it's interesting how the function of the gao is a lot like the function of a manuscript copy in early copyright law. And so part of my interest was to draw our focus on the circulation of existing sources rather than on the question of that there is an existing source at all. Theoretical terms, it's hard to say that any work of art is not derived from some source or another. But what does it mean when a practice is contingent upon the circulation and use of very particular sources, that being photographic reproductions of existing paintings? So that is, in essence, what Dafan painters, I think most strictly speaking, we can say they are doing. They are painting after an existing painting from which they have only a very, very small and often fuzzy reproduction. Now, what they do with these reproductions, you know, varies with different kinds of painters. But that is, I think, the fairest way we can, and just the clearest way we can put what they are doing without the cultural and historical and value judgments of words like originality and copying and creativity. Does that help a bit?
Oh, that's great. Thank you. So this is this idea that Dafan paintings are simply forgeries of Western masterpieces is really one of several assumptions that the book is going to upend and undermine. So in addition to this, again, this idea that paintings are just forgeries of Western masterpieces, the book is going to also undermine the idea that Dafan is a village, right? It sort of asks us to think anew about what that means. Mm-hmm. The idea that Dafan is a single factory. You're mm-hmm. undermining that. And also the idea that production in Dafan is something we can think of as a mass assembly line. And this mm-hmm. actually brings us into the first chapter. So chapter one offers some historical grounding to place what happened in Dafan within a larger context. Now you take us into this sort of story of the transfer of trade painting networks from Hong Kong, as you put it, here to South China in the 1980s. You also take us into the emergence of the narrative of industrialization as mm-hmm. a way to describe what's happening in Dafan Village. Mm-hmm. Part of this then is going to involve another rhetorical move that emerges in concert with these ideas, and that's the move to describe what's happening in Dafan in terms of the rhetoric of assembly line painting. Now, mm-hmm. this becomes really important for us to understand not just what's happening in Dafan, but also the contributions that your book is making to, more broadly, how we understand and talk about labor, mm-hmm. labor practices. So could you bring us into what you think is the most important parts of this first chapter by maybe getting us started in talking about what is so pervasive about this assembly line rhetoric, mm-hmm. and how do the practices that you observed and took part in Dafan undermine that assembly line rhetoric?
I think the best story to encapsulate this problem is what the Dafan boss, who claimed to have made, I think it's 500,000 paintings in 52 days for Walmart.
Right?
I think it's very interesting to take his story, which I question in various aspects, but even if we take his story, I think it's very interesting to see how the practice undoes our expectations of what industrialization does to what we imagine to be individual creativity. So he claims that the reason he had to invent the assembly line in order to meet this massive order from Walmart was that if normally what would happen in Dafan, and orders of this size were at the time not it was not the first time, not so unprecedented. But what you would normally do and what you would do now is that you would just get enough painters to each do a certain number of it. So if you had to do 1,000 paintings, you would get 100 painters to each do 10, right? Or, you know, whatever number that you would do in time. What he said was that he needed to create an assembly line because if every painter painted their paintings their own way, then every painting would be different, right? So this this is a sort of acknowledgement that the work is really quite individualistic, at least in its results. And so he surmised, he guessed, he has no proof really, that that Walmart, or you know, the order of his paintings, would not accept this. And so in order to create the impression of a single hand, of a single individual behind all, say, you know, 1,000 paintings, he needed to create an assembly line in which everybody took one piece or one step so that all of the results would look similar. Now, this is the very opposite of what we think or what we had imagined industrialization is supposed to do, which is to separate the tasks so as to de-individualize each worker. And so I find this story, or at least the rationale that he gives for a somewhat apocryphal tale, is quite fascinating, because it tells us that it's the market demand for individuality that, in fact, in this case, causes a division of labor and not the other way around.
Thank you. And so the chapter really positions this idea of assembly line painting as what you call a cultural imaginary, and it opens up a kind of contextualizing of the different kinds of labor practices that go into this imaginary, including those of individual painters, including practices of the emergent figure of an artist boss, who becomes really, really important here. And you also take us into the very different kinds of, I mean, there's some consistent features, but different kinds of workshops and, quote, factories that constitute the landscape of artistic production in Dafan. Now, one of the things that's happening in this chapter that I think actually happens in every chapter that's really, really great, at least for me, from the perspective of one reader, is that you're introducing in each of these chapters at least one work that by a contemporary artist that is playing with, calling into question, or otherwise epitomizing some of the phenomena that you are bringing us into in that chapter. And here, this is work by Beijing conceptual artist Liu Ding. Mm-hmm. Now, this artist organized a performance piece called Products that became quite controversial, and it became controversial in ways that, again, really speak to the kinds of phenomena and practices that you're problematizing here. So could you maybe talk about that project for us? What's important for us to understand about Products, this performance piece?
Okay, so on the one hand, the Walmart story is meant to tell us that Dafen Village does not exist in a kind of pre-industrial state, and that we shouldn't try to understand contemporary China as a sort of backwards, sort of trying to catch up with a history of European industrialization. My use of contemporary artists and conceptual artists who engage with Dafen is also meant similarly to challenge the idea that Dafen is completely outside the norms of the art world, the highest art world that we know it today, which is in the form of the global artists who participates in an international art market and institutional system. So Liu Ding is a wonderful example, I think, of how ignoring this sort of simultaneity of Dafen with high art and with contemporary art skews the politics of controversies, shall we say. So in Liu Ding's case, he went to Dafen Village and said to have brought to Guangzhou, to the Guangzhou Triennial, a team of assembly line workers from a factory who would demonstrate their sort of regular standard product production method. What I found was that it wasn't really a factory, it was a network of artists, and the painters who participated had never actually worked together before. They were friends who wanted to go on an outing. Actually, they thought of it as a public art kind of exchange, cultural exchange, artist exchange kind of event. Neither had any one of them before worked on an assembly line of such a number of painters, such a large number of painters, and none of them had actually worked together on that particular painting before. Okay. Nevertheless, they were able to kind of half demonstrate quite poorly, actually, what the process could have been imagined to have been by the artist. And I think this is interesting insofar as it locates Liu Ding within the rhetoric of the assembly line factory, which I'm arguing now is used more by bosses like him, in essence, like the artist Liu Ding, in order to forward a certain kind of managerial power and power over scale that they might have. Now, what does it mean to sort of elide the artist's version of the story with actual practice? It means that critics of Liu Ding's work focused on how much he paid the painters, and he defended himself by saying that he paid them a standard wage. And one thing that I point out is that it's actually impossible to really we don't know what would be a fair and standard wage in this situation, and that the disparities between what the painters perceive they should get and what the art world is willing and able to give them is actually what we should focus on, not the question of labor exploitation in a factory, which doesn't exist. So I think this is why I'm trying to point out that sort of careful attention to the actual practices in exchange is so important in understanding what we now call socially engaged art. Artists have been going all around the world doing projects with small communities. And I think we need to take their challenge seriously and to really look at those communities that they're engaging with in order to understand their work.
Now, the next chapter also explores aspects of practice of these painters by taking us into another really fascinating work. And this is a work that was created in 2009 by an Amsterdam-based video artist. Now, this artist was exploring, among other things, the notion of skill and the relationship between skill and the practicing of skill and the identity of and the formation of and the performance of identity of these Dafan artists. So could you bring us briefly into that project and maybe use it to talk a little bit about how you understand the importance of skill coming up in this context?
So the artist Sasha Pohl, early on in my dissertation work, I had published a short essay about Dafan in an art magazine, and he read it and came to me and said that he would like to come to Dafan to make a video project which would be reenactments of Hollywood movies about artists, and that specifically he wanted, for example, to find a Van Gogh painter to act as Kirk Douglas in Lust for Life, and so on and so forth. And I asked him, but he then told me that he did not speak Chinese, and that he had no budget. And so I thought this would be essentially impossible to do. But he came and I watched I participated in a few of his trial runs. And then what happened was that he came back and spent another, I think, 9 months in Dafan and produced what I think is an incredibly impressive video, which you have to see for yourself to see what it kind of reveals. And I spent a lot of time trying to understand how someone working in such a different way than I was, in other words, without language skills and without a sort of, he didn't even speak English as his first language, and neither did his translator, who resubtitled this film, speak or write English as a first language, nor Dutch, which is what he's, German, which is what his first language is. Anyway, there were all of these sort of moments for mistranslation to occur in this process, obviously. And what he managed to do was nevertheless so revealing of what's happening in Dafan. And we ended up showing the video again and in Dafan at the Museum of Art. And what was so amazing was we invited many of the painters to come back to see the film after it was done. And it was just wonderful that everybody laughed at the same time. And we had at the time a screening with well-known Chinese artists, well-known foreign artists, and often painters. And everybody found the same things comical. And so I wondered, part of that chapter is about talking about what it is that painterly skill and artistic kind of social skill means, and to show that in essence, Sasha Pola and the Dafan painters he worked with actually understood very well the same spectrum of problems when it comes to both acquiring skill and performing it as an artist.
Great. Now, this issue of translation and mistranslation actually comes up really interestingly in another of the chapters. So I'm just going to kind of bring us there. In chapter 5, you look at another really, really fascinating set of relationships among several different pieces that are pieces by photojournalists, documentary photographers, and conceptual artists. And in one of these cases, translation also winds up playing a really interesting role in terms of how the final pieces look and how they're understood by the people involved. So let's kind of work our way there. Now, this is a chapter that takes on and really it just becomes a kind of mystery story in this fabulous way. This is one of my favorite chapters. I'll just say chapter five.
Okay.
So it takes us into the relationships between several works. I think the best way to do this is for me to kind of hit the ball back to you and ask you to talk about some of these works. So you start us off with this piece by Michael Wolff called China Copy Painters. So what do we need to know about the 2006 Michael Wolff piece, China Copy Painters, in order to understand what's going to come next?
Michael Wolff is a very well-known photojournalist and also documentary photographer based in Hong Kong. His work tends to involve very, very large series of sort of the same composition. His photographs are absolutely striking and extremely evocative. He did a series on Daphne Village called China Copy Artist, which he later called Real Fake Art. And he later did later iterations of the project as I was working on it. So in essence, I think that some of my work is sort of engaging in a dialogue with him as he's sort of transitioning from a photojournalist to documentary photographer, and I would like to argue a conceptual artist, though he does not make that claim. What is interesting to me is that the compositions of his photographs of Daphne Village, again, run counter to what I found to have taken place in the making of them, in the practice of making of them. So the photographs look as though there are many, many painters in Daphne who copy the most erudite, the most hippest, the trendiest of current contemporary art concerns. So in 2006, Neil Rauch. The photographs look as though there are all of these painters producing Neil Rauch on Kawara, you name it, at the time, just really super cool, too cool to be true. And what I found was that the photographs are largely staged, and they are, not only are they staged, the paintings in them were chosen by the photographer, Michael Wolff, and that he commissioned each one of them, and that every one of them was, I mean, not everyone, but the vast majority were painted by a single painter who comes to eventually figure quite centrally in my research and in the work of many other conceptual artists who came to Daphne. So my interest in Michael Wolff's work, again, like all the other conceptual artists, is in showing how what the artist is sort of forwarding as a sort of image of Daphne is quite different from the practice there, and what that difference actually tells us, in this case, about the function, the difference between documentary and conceptual art, which have always been intertwined, and yet I'm arguing here maintains an important institutional and ethical difference.
Now, this Daphne painter, Yin Shunzhi, winds up being really, really important in many ways in this chapter. One of the ways that we meet him is through your explanation of and your introduction of another 2007 work called China Painters. And this is a context where, as I was alluding to before, you're showing us the ways that something as simple as an interpreter or a translator, right, who's there ostensibly to mediate communication among this artist, Yankowski, on the one hand, and the Daphne painter artist, Yin Shunzhi, on the other hand, is actually through the interpreter's choice of how to translate and what this interpreter thinks is going to communicate or not, is actually materially impacting the final product in really, really interesting ways. Okay, so there's a lot of fascinating stuff going on there, and I'm just going to point listeners to this chapter, chapter five, because there's so much interesting detail here that's just really surprising and shocking, and I've got exclamation points all over the margins here. But what winds up happening toward the end of this chapter is you take us into your own re-photographing of Yinxunzhi. And this becomes a kind of not just an analysis on your part, but also a kind of performance piece on your part. So could you talk a little bit about that aspect of what's going on and your own engagement in this as a kind of performance piece in this chapter?
So actually, I though I suggest that it could be interpreted as a performance piece, I want very much to emphasize that I don't regard what my photographs of Yinxunzhi as a performance piece at all. There are really, I should clarify my reasons for that. So what basically happened was that I was carrying around photographs of Michael Wolff's, a small kind of reproductions of his photographs that I had downloaded from his website. I was carrying them around because I wanted to research it. I wanted to research the work. I wanted to find the painters in it to interview them. I wanted to find the buildings and the places where they've been photographed and the galleries that seem to be showing these paintings. And it was extremely unexpected. That day I went to meet Yinxunzhi, who actually I know as Da Huzi, which is how he's known in Dafen. So I happened to go to meet Da Huzi that day for a completely other reason, which was to interview him about Christian Yankowski's 2007 project. But as soon as I met him, I recognized him from a photograph by Michael Wolff. And it's incredibly serendipitous, or rather maybe it shows how small social networks among artists are. He was the one who said to me, but I painted all of these paintings in these photographs. And so this is how I came to understand very coincident or serendipitously another version of Michael Wolff's photographs. So I didn't believe him at first, of course. And so I interviewed him, and then he said, you know, I'll show you where all of these buildings were taken. And he took all of my photographs, and we went on a tour of the village where he showed me the site of every photograph. And I don't really know how it happened that he then mimicked the composition of Michael Wolff's photographs and said, you know, take a picture of me here. Or perhaps I don't even remember whose first idea it was. But I ended up taking photographs of him at each site, holding my reproduction of Wolff's photographs. And I thought he was proving to me that he knew all the sites and had painted all the paintings in them. But later on, and you know, now I've known Da Huzi for years, and we've talked about this this and many other projects for over the years, and both of our opinions and feelings have changed about them. But at the time, soon after, I realized that perhaps what he was doing was demonstrating to me that I could also come and make the same paintings with him and the same photographs, and this would bring him a lot of business because Michael Wolff was his best client. And so I think in this encounter and in many other I want to emphasize how the boundary between conceptual art and commercial practice can be closely intertwined, and perhaps just a matter of tone. But those are sort of differences that I want to kind of attend to with each individual piece.
Great. I mean, it is really interesting how, because of the framing of your photographs in the context of the plates, right? So they're juxtaposed with Wolff's original photographs in a way that very much just strictly for the reader or observer through that technology of visual juxtaposition invites us to see your photographs in a way that is like the photographs of Wolff, and thus in a way that's akin to a kind of artistic performance or conceptual art, even if it wasn't intended that way, right? Or even if it's not definitively that way. And this is interesting because it raises another issue that I think is really beautifully taken up in another one of the chapters, or a set of issues, both the issue of authorship and kind of positioning and selfhood as a figure, as a creative figure, and also the issue of your own integration into and your own participant observation in the practices that you're chronicling for us. And this is chapter 4. So chapter four looks at the relationship, among other things, between craft and an idea of craft, and also at the same time modernist authorship and signature practices. And really, signature is very much a practice as well as an object in the context of this chapter. So the chapter takes us into a Van Gogh specialty workshop and also into the retail and wholesale trade in Van Gogh paintings. And it was based at least in part on 3 months, as you tell us in the chapter, of participant observation in the workshop of a particular artist. So can you maybe take us into that aspect of what's going on here? What were for you, as of this moment right now, some of the most notable or important elements of your own experience as a painter in this workshop that shaped the way you were thinking about the issues that you're treating in this part of the book?
So I should emphasize that the sort of ethnographic method of this book was sort of invented on the fly. I just did what seemed to make sense at the time. But what ultimately happened was that I ended up in my first sort of few months of the fieldwork adopting different roles in Daphne Village. So first, essentially as a tourist, and then as a consumer. And one thing that I began doing was to, put down orders for paintings for friends. And I needed to do that because every painter I met told me that they could paint anything in 2 weeks. And so I realized that the only way I could really engage with the question of what they could or could not paint was to order paintings from them. And so I began trading in paintings, and then, I began translating for artists, and I began interviewing artists, and I began translating for other conceptual artists who were coming. Then I was serving as sort of a translator for non-artists who were coming to buy paintings. And once I became conscious of the fact that I was actually adopting different roles that exist in Dauphin and that they sort of coincided with a lot of what people do, you sort of, as a migrant worker, you come to Dauphin and you do what you can, and you learn different aspects of the trade, and you try to kind of move fluidly between potential kind of avenues of work. I realized that if I was going to do this as a researcher, I needed to be a little bit more comprehensive in all the roles I was adopting. And so I figured that I would learn to, I would apprentice myself as a migrant worker would. And so when a migrant worker arrives at Dauphin, they usually start out at the working in the trade specialty, which is the easiest to produce and the cheapest. So the easiest paintings and the cheapest paintings in Dauphin are Van Gogh paintings. So I thought I would start there, and I had hoped that I would move all the way up, but obviously ran out of time. So I asked a Van Gogh painter whom I already knew at the time and had spent quite a few hours and over several months interviewing, that I asked him to be my teacher. He understood this to be a form of sort of research, a sort of play, but a sort of work. And he allowed me to come in every 2 days and ostensibly apprentice, although our relationship was always sort of, in a way, negotiated between my research and my work. So, for example, he explained to me that to be a proper Van Gogh painter, one must learn 5 major Van Gogh works, self-portrait, Starry Night, Sunflowers, Irises, and the bar scene, the night cafe. And I only did 2 before I asked him if I could paint some other things, because I wanted to see how he engaged with Van Gogh that he had never seen nor painted, for example. So there were various ways in which we kind of played with my role there, and from which I learned a great deal just from sitting there and doing it, and hanging out with him and his family and his subletters and his teachers. But I also learned a lot from his engagement with me being there, and all the various friends from throughout the village who knew I was a actually a researcher and not a migrant worker. They would come and joke about it and watch me paint and laugh at, you know, laugh at what I was doing. And many people came to call me the, ironically, the migrant worker from MIT, which is where I was doing my dissertation. So I think I learned as much from, you know, a sort of classic, I guess, ethnographic practice as I did from their awareness of my, my sort of attempt to perform as an ethnographer.
And this chapter does really interesting work for listeners that are particularly engaged with these issues in asking us to think about and sort of rethink notions that are germane to the kinds of practices that you're describing coming from your own experience in the workshop. And these are practices of signing, the idea of a signature, mm-hmm. and the larger conventions of authorship, ideas about authorship, practices of authorship, assumptions about authorship that come out of this context. And so there's a really interesting discussion of that in this chapter that I'll just sort of signal mm-hmm. for listeners rather than having the time to talk about it in detail. We could talk about that for another hour or two, probably. So you mentioned, though, and this is why I want to move on just a little bit, you mentioned a term that winds up becoming really, really important throughout the book, but that's really taken on centrally in chapter 3, and this is the term mm-hmm. migrant worker. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a really important part of the work that the book is doing, but here in this context, you take us into the ways that the party state, right, the Chinese party state, is using particular subject figures in propaganda tools, and here it's television shows in particular, in order to construct an image of creativity that's very specific to migrant workers, and very specific to female migrant workers in particular. So this is a chapter that really takes on the ways that the figure of a woman, the figure of a migrant worker, and the figure of creativity are imbricated in, I think, really interesting ways. So you look here at two propaganda products. One of them is a 5-part TV documentary about three women artists and bosses that was produced and aired on CCTV1. This is Story of the Oil Painting Village. And another is a 20-episode TV melodrama set in a fictionalized version of Dafan and produced by Guangdong Provincial TV Network. And this was a melodrama called Painted Fate. So could you, for us, just, you know, briefly choose one of these TV shows, whichever one you're particularly interested in at this moment in time right now, and maybe talk a little bit about the way that this idea of creativity comes out of the particular propagandistic elements of the TV program.
So these TV series, one a documentary, one a melodrama, they're not the only Dafan propaganda products that are focused on women, but I did want to focus on them because they constructed such a striking and different figure of the female migrant worker than we have seen in the Pearl River Delta, where there has been a great deal of study of female migrant workers. And I think we could think about how the term Da Gong Mei has kind of transitioned over the course of 30 years in China from sort of being little country sisters to, we could say, working girls, and what that kind of shift kind of implies and engenders. But Da Gong Mei is never used in either one of these Dafan sort of stories, propaganda stories of Dafan. And rather the focus is on true love and on women who become either artists or bosses and wives at the same time. So this chapter really made me see how central and how neglected the role and the figure of the laobanyang, meaning the boss lady, is in both in Chinese contemporary experience and in migrant worker experience. And I think that's itself a subject deserving of its own study. But I think what the CCTV documentary on the story of Da Fen begins with the story of a handicapped migrant worker. She only has, I think, one functional hand with only two fingers. It begins with how she went from being a migrant worker and with the support of the state became a creative artist. And the second story talks about a retired illustrator who comes to Da Fen and realizes her dream of becoming a creative artist, again with the sponsorship of the state. And however, the third story is the story of a woman who becomes a very good boss lady without the implied sponsorship of the state. And so I think it's very interesting here how this kind of documentary negotiates both the sort of market forces, the ideological forces, the various conditions of these women. It's kind of representing different types of women of different ages. But in the end, ends on a sort of entrepreneurial woman whose only motivation is love. So that, I think, what I was trying to argue is that this particular configuration is quite new and tells us something about the tensions that those making propaganda are actually trying to negotiate.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, as we come to the end of the book, we come to a conclusion that takes us into the Da Fen Pavilion that was mounted in the 2010 Shanghai World Exposition. And you talk both about that expo, and you also talk about your own experience helping to mount a concurrent exhibition at the Da Fen Museum of Art. Now, there are lots of things that are interesting that come up in this conclusion, but one of the most interesting kind of products that emerges, at least for one reader, is this product called the Da Fen Lisa, right? A kind of a play mm-hmm. on the Mona Lisa. Now, you take us into this context where 500 Da Fen painters were collectively producing this work that they didn't realize, right, ostensibly what they were producing at the time. But we have, again, in the close of the book, this image that kind of reflects the image we began with, right? A group mm-hmm. of people sitting and making copies. This is where we started. This is also kind of where we end. So mm-hmm. in order to kind of bring out what you take to be the most important elements of this for listeners, can you talk a little bit about this product, this project, and what you take to be some of the most important aspects of this project for embodying the points that you're making here at the end of the book?
The book emphasizes both, I think to put it short, I want to draw out how closely aligned in politics and in rhetorics the conceptual artists are with the Chinese propaganda producers. And what I mean by that is that with the Da Fen Lisa, I think we have an extremely similar kind of set of a very similar framework, namely that those sort of working with the state loosely, you know, with sort of rough idea of what state ideology or what might be expected, come to Da Fen and create some kind of project which both showcases them as people, they need to appear in it, right, and which emphasizes how they are merely assembly line copyists or forgers who can maybe together in positive senses produce a collective work and in negative senses not. But this is a sort of a similar move by the curators of the Shanghai World Expo Pavilion. And I, in fact, believe that they were inspired by a Los Angeles-based artist who had been making or continues to make large paintings in dafen made up out of smaller pixels of a large image, and have been doing that since actually the beginning of my research. So they knew of this artist's work through our proposals to mount an exhibition at the Dafen Museum of Art. And I do think they were inspired by this artist's proposal. So I just want to point out that ultimately my argument is that what they showcase is not so different about Dafen is not so different than what conceptual artists showcase. And once again, what is amazing is how little it has to do with actual practice in Dafen and how little of the agency of Dafen painters they actually show, even as their stated political concern is to help them to realize their dreams as artists.
Right. And so one of the things that's happening with these artists is that, you know, they're, if I'm recalling correctly, they're collected together in a park, and each one of these 500 painters is given an image that they're then charged with copying, right? Or but copying, this is in quotation marks, and I'm invoking this term in this much broader, more problematizing sense that we've been talking about for an hour. On the flip side of their painting, that again, they're sort of making with reference to this reference piece or this gal that they've been given, if we can call it a gal, on the flip side, they're signing it, which becomes important because of the work that previous chapters of the book have done to direct our attention to the importance of signature as a practice in various ways. And they're also indicating their secret dreams, as you put in the back. And often, as you tell us at the end of this chapter, those secret dreams involve becoming recognized artists. And so this is, I think, a useful thing to keep in mind. Also, in the context of your own naming practices in the book, that again, you state at the very beginning, but here we come back to at the very end. You mentioned to us very explicitly that almost all the painters and artists asked to be publicly named in your book. And so this relationship, I think, between the kind of naming of these artists as individuals, the way that they are signing themselves, the way that you are signing them, becomes a really, really interesting way to think about signing and naming and selfhood and the construction of selfhood, not just for the Dafen artists, but also for ourselves.
And I just want to emphasize the real question there is, why do the dreams have to be secret, and why do they have to be revealed, and what is it that is actually going on in that process of asking others to make visible what is does not need to be a secret? I mean, that artists want to be recognized as artists. Why should that be continually surprising?
And I think this notion, this fits along with what you're doing elsewhere in the book, is even the notion of secret, right? And the way that's bound up with ideas of selfhood and individuality and what's is also very usefully problematized here. So Winnie, we're now at the end of our hour, and there's a million billion things in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. But is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers? Is there anything really important that we didn't touch on?
No, I think you've covered it admirably.
And hopefully listeners will find a copy of the book themselves, because one thing we absolutely can't do justice to in the medium of an oral podcast is the real beauty of and the centrality of the images in the book, which are very much part of the argument and very, very central for understanding and experiencing what you are bringing us into.
Thank you.
So Winnie, now that the book is out, you've already talked a little bit about part of what the next project might be, and it may or may not, right, involve going back to these handbags, which I hope you'll go back to at some point. But would you tell us a little bit about what's next for you and what's currently inspiring you?
Yes, I am currently co-editing a volume with Marianne O'Donnell, who I mentioned earlier, an ethnographer of Xinjiang for over I think now 20 years coming on, and Jonathan Bach, who heads Global Studies at Parsons New School, and we are just finishing up a co-edited volume with a lot of other collaborators on the history of Shenzhen. It's a sort of 30-year history as told by people from different disciplines, all of whom have worked on the ground at specific sites. So though Dafen is to me so fascinating, another fascinating thing about it is the next village over has a completely different story that is the complete opposite of everything that Dafen is. Sort of the process of doing this research in Dafen alongside others who were doing field work in Shenzhen at the time sort of made us realize how there is no sort of just comprehensive and explainable history of Shenzhen in China studies or in global urban studies. And we wanted to just put together a very accessible text that will just introduce people to the complexities of this city and what it represents in China, for contemporary China, but also what it represents for the use of cities as a site of policy, of history, and as research. That project is entitled Learning from Shenzhen, and I hope that everyone will look for it, because we're working very hard to sort of just show how interesting Shenzhen is as a site of research. The other project I'm working on, of course, is this longer and historical study of oil painting done in the Pearl River Delta, namely Guangzhou, since about 1730s, but as early as 1610. And I think I can just simply say that if we recognize that oil painting has been bought by Western consumers, oil paintings made in China have been bought by Western consumers since the 18th century and again in the present day. We can think of the Western consumption of Chinese ink painting, which fills our museums today, as only an interlude in a much longer and a very rich history of Sino-Western cultural and artistic engagement.
Great. Well, best of luck with both of those books, and I'll eagerly look forward to reading both of them. And thanks very much, Winnie, for making the time. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we will see you next time.